Welcome to the podcast that's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee. We have a different crew with us here today. We have Trainer Road and Cannondale's Amber Pierce.
Hello, everybody.
We have Trainer Road and Cliff Bar Racing's Pete Morris.
How's it going, guys?
And we have a special guest with us all the way across over in Belgium right now, Iman Lucas. How you doing, Iman?
I'm well. Thank you for having me on the podcast today. I'm stoked to be here.
For sure. So we're going to get into everything about who you are, what you do, and we're going to learn a lot about bike racing today, like we do typically, but this time it's really going to be focused on just bike racing. So buckle up for that. It'll be a lot of fun. Before we do that, just a couple of things to announce really quick. If you are listening to this podcast, you should absolutely be listening to the Successful Athletes podcast and the Science of Getting Faster podcast. You can do so down at links below. So check those out. The other thing, the new mobile apps, like we announced last week, they have been released for Android and iOS. And you can also see a video that we are going to have up here on our YouTube channel. And if you're curious and you're listening to this on our podcast instead of watching on YouTube, then you can check out that video where Pete, Nate, and I actually break down everything that's new about those apps. We even have great screen captures. You can see everything. It's super cool. A few people have also mentioned the fact that the new app feels really slow. And the reason for that, if you have been with Trainer Road for a while, it's migrating all of your data over to the new app. Because this isn't a small update. It's like a big update. And when that happens, as a result, it's got some stuff to be able to move from one point to another. As a result, it'll be slow for the first little bit, but just let it run through its process. And then after that, it's super snappy and quick. So just wanted to get that one out there. Then also for an update on adaptive training, we just added another bunch of users of athletes to the closed beta for adaptive training, which is really exciting. We've been adding to it weekly and continuing to expand that pool. And it's really exciting stuff. So you can check out and get more information for that at the forum, forum.trainerroad.com. And if you want to sign up for the closed beta, go to trainerroad.com/AT. Okay, so Iman, I didn't introduce you as a member of your team. I should have done that. So
No worries.
Can you explain the team that you race for really quick, just so then we can properly introduce you?
Yeah, I am racing for a top level elite amateur team here in Belgium called Shifting Gears Kermesse. They're based out of Bruges, Belgium, West Flanders. But it's basically started off with a bunch of guys that had a huge passion for cycling and liked to drink Belgian beer. And then over the years, it kind of evolved into, okay, we want to do some bigger starts and we need some better guys and we need some more serious guys. But it never really lost the camaraderie and the mentality of hard racing. So yeah, I'm racing for Shifting Gears Kermesse out of Bruges.
Awesome. So now I think Pete, you've raced with Iman for how long now?
Since intermingled with me.
Yeah, actually I looked it up because I was curious about this one. So the first time we raced was Cherry Pie Crit in 2010, I think. And we were Cat Threes. And I won. So it's fine.
Hey, that's cool. No big deal.
I think that's the only time.
I'll hang up, Pete.
No, I was going to say, I think that's the only time I beat you for the rest of our racing careers. So I'm okay with that. No, we also raced a bunch of national level crits. And when you were on the crit life, we used to be at a lot of the same races. Yeah. So I've always enjoyed the way you race and having you around. So it's cool to kind of look back now and then see where we still are and that cycling's still an important part of our lives, which is pretty cool to me.
Yeah, we definitely do have a bit of history.
No doubt. And then Amber, for you, I mean, I know that you hadn't met Iman prior to this, but you've raced in Europe. You lived in Europe while racing professionally at the World Tour level. And I'm sure that you raced a whole bunch of different races. So I'm excited to get all of us here together to talk about race tactics, because I bet that we'll discover that even though all of us listen to this, we have an idea of what our races unfold like. And that's kind of bike racing for us, right? Like our narrow view. But I'm looking forward to this because it will expand our horizons a bit and show some different perspectives on what bike racing is. Iman, I'm just going to run through a couple things really quick, because rather than get too much into your past, I really want to talk about your present and really talk about what you're doing now. But one of the more notable things, like Pete mentioned, you rose through the ranks of racing on the American side of things with doing road races and crits. You really started to specialize in crit racing, which I understand actually was kind of like you signed with a team and you were sent to the crit team, which at first you weren't too stoked about, but it ended up being awesome.
Right.
Then you ended up racing for the Rocket Espresso team, I believe, right. In the Red Hook crit scene. So that's fixed gear bikes. I want to talk about that for a little bit. Like, first of all,
yeah, please.
Had you raced or had you ridden fixed gears before you like got into racing these? Or was it just like, you're an awesome crit racer, here you go, hop on this fixed gear bike and race these crazy crits?
Yeah, actually, I remember I was hosting my teammate at the time, Aldo Ilicic, who was on Astellas, and he had a meeting in California at the Specialized headquarters. And he was like, I want you on the team. And he was gone all day long. And he came to the door and he said, you're on the team. You can get your bike next week. And that's pretty much how I got on the team. Thanks to Aldo. And then I remember just going for my first rides on my fixed gear bike. And I was just like, man, this is wild. Like, you really can't stop. Like, I'm not even going down a hill, and it's not even straight. It's like a straight road, like on the back of like an alley. And I'm like scared. And I have to be like Red Hook ready in a month. And so it was pretty, yeah, it was get good quick and get good quick. Eh?
How did you do that? Like, did you go out? Was it basically like trying to pair your fitness with your skills, or did you feel like you kind of had to relearn how to exploit your fitness in that realm of fixed gear racing?
Yeah. I mean, what I learned from the racing aspect of things, if you just stay near the front, everyone has, I mean, on a fixed gear bike, everyone has the same, you know, motive. Don't stop pedaling. Everyone needs to move in sync. And so if you just stay at the front and you stay flowy, you really don't have to be too much on the gear. You just keep pedaling. And the course is set up to cater to that. If you get in the back, which I never really found myself in the back, I think it would be scary. But yeah, I really felt like when I was learning how to ride my fixed gear bike, it was more or less just letting go mentally and telling yourself you're going to be okay. Because I mean, how often are you really on your brakes on your road bike? Like, not that much, but you have the safety in the back of your head saying, I have brakes, I'm going to be okay. So it was turning that safety off, relying on my bike handling skills that I knew I had, and just pedaling through corners that I normally would pedal through, but not knowing I didn't have brakes. You know, I couldn't stop. So it's okay. Pedal through it. You'll get through it. And that's how I got good fast.
Did you realize, or did you notice this? That's crazy, by the way. First of all,
it is crazy. I mean, it's easy to be said, but if you really think about it, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you notice that made you a better, away from the fixed gear racing scene, did that make you a better bike racer in any way?
Oh my gosh. I was able to get through gaps. I was able to make turns. I was able to put myself in situations where I never would ever thought to put myself before, just because I had brakes. I maneuver crashes, you know, get myself out of sticky situations before they occurred, whatever it might be. It just, everything rose.
Yeah. So the Red Hook crit series kind of, it came to an end, a sad end.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. And then you ended up transferring over to racing in Europe eventually. And the thing that hits close to home for us is that when you are back in the States, we race within the same district. So one might say that it's fun to see you there, and it is, but it's also terrifying to see you there as a person that's also in those fields, because if Iman's there, everyone really ups their game and they know it's going to be a hard race. You can actually see, we have a race analysis from a race at Land Park, I believe in 2019.
Yeah.
And Iman was in that race, and we probably have footage from Pete, Nate, and I in that race. And we just, I think all of us exploded into pieces at some point. So thanks, Iman. I appreciate your presence, really raises the bar. Man.
It was all eyes on me, and I couldn't get away. And yeah, it was a race. I think I did like 420 watts normalized for 75 minutes.
it was
pretty hard.
It was brutal. You were being attacked left, right, and center. But why did you end up going over to race in Europe? Because traditionally, like, you know, traditionally there's this track that a person would follow in the United States, at least, where it's kind of like you get a ride on a good elite team, then you might get a ride for like a pro continental team, something like that. And then, you know, fast forward of paying dues and you end up, you're Sepkus, you know, you're over on Jumbo Visma or something. And it's like, but they usually don't make that leap over to Europe unless it's like at that world tour level. So your path is unorthodox. which I mean could possibly also be said for Amber's path too, being not quite what everybody would have anticipated. So why did you choose to go to Europe?
I was sick and tired of doing the same races, to be honest with you, in the most respectful way putting that. You know, I was, you know, it was cool. I was winning those races when I was 20, 21, 22, 23. I was winning Dairylands. I was winning, you know, America, OKC races. I was winning, you know, NRC level crits, and I was part of teams that were winning those races. So, I mean, it was really crucial in my development to be winning those, but it was also in the back of my mind, it wasn't my end all be all. I wanted more. I wanted to be challenged. In a way I didn't want to be the big fish. I wanted to, you know, grow. And so I needed to be put out of my comfort zone and grow.
And when over in Europe, you and I spoke about this when we raced recently, there's not, at least for me, I'll just speak personally. So sorry for everybody listening. I won't speak.
But you mean that training ride that I thought was a race because I couldn't talk the whole time because you were just riding so fast.
All right. We need to break down these barriers. We're just, Iman's like, I'm going for an easy ride. I'm like, all right, sounds great. I've got a hard ride later, so it's going to be easy.
He brings his venge and he's trying to talk to me and I'm from sea level and he's at altitude and I can't even talk.
I was like, this is Iman's recovery pace. This is insane. Like, I'm dying over here. So we're both like operating on this false pretense. Iman, we should have just talked. We should have just hugged it out and then it would have just been so easy.
Well, I tried and he just half wheeled me the whole ride. And I'm like, well, I guess I better ride next to him so he doesn't think I'm weak. Like,
oh man. So, but a lot of us don't realize that there's like, we kind of, and if we stop and think about it, of course it makes sense. But when we think of European racing, we think of like World Tour races. We think of the spring classics that are going on right now over in Belgium, for example, but we don't think of much else. So can you explain this Kermesse style racing, what it is and where that fits in to kind of like the maybe rank and file is a bad way to say it, but like where it fits in relation to like World Tour racing.
Yeah. Like the tier classification of like, yeah the whole nine. Yeah. Yeah, these Kermesses are, I don't even almost know a word or a way to describe them. But like I told you, they're like a knife fight. And 150 guys show up with their buck knife. And the guy that can take the most stabbings wins. Like, you know, it's just basically, I'm going to stab you and you're going to stab me. And I'm going to, whoever falls is the loser and whoever stands is the winner. And that's pretty much the mentality it is. It's cutthroat. It's aggressive. It's mean. It's scary, especially being an American or a foreigner. I mean, these guys don't want you to take what is rightfully theirs. I mean, you're in their country, so I guess there's that aspect. But, you know, it's everyone's able to start these races, so it's not really anybody's. It's the strongest guy and the smartest guy in a lot of these cases. And I don't mean smart as bike racing smart. I mean smart as who's at the race. Whose town are you in? Are there friends there? Are, you know, have they paid off the bookmakers? Are they, you know, being bought in the breakaway? Like, you got to know the whole nine. Like, it's really about reading the field and being part of the mafia. Like, if you're in the mafia, it's easy. If you're not in the mafia, you're going to die.
So these like criteriums, road races, or circuits, what are they most similar to?
They would be like a 3 to 5 mile circuit race. So you'd probably do anywhere from, 12 to 18 laps of these, you know, open circuit, races.
So like circuit racing, Amber, did you do a lot of that in the States or more of it in Europe? Like us amateurs, actually, we don't really have a whole lot of like circuit race opportunities, it seems like.
In the States, there were a few kind of standalone circuit races, and then once in a while, you'd have one thrown into a stage race. But in Europe, we were doing mostly stage racing and road racing, and then a few of the road races would really be more Kermesse style. But that was Kermesse style racing is like its own category. It's like there's just nothing else really like it. It's really hard. As Iman's describing, it's its own beast completely.
And is that just because, so why is it so unique? To give people even more context on this, Iman, you said that anybody can just show up and register. So is
you can't have a UCI Pro license. I mean, they have their own pro kermesses that if I wanted to get, I would go to the organization and say, hey, I'm an amateur, I want a wild card. And then they have these organizations have like 20 to 30 open spots for these amateurs to start these wild cards to fill the peloton. And then, so, you know, if I get there in time and the organization likes me and, you know, I'm on good standings, and then I get a wild card and then I can start. So you can't be anybody, but you can be any amateur can start these races.
Got it.
Cool. And yeah.
Sure. So another thing about the spring classics that we see a lot of the time, the races actually kind of take place within the same kind of like compressed area. A lot of the races in Belgium mm-hmm. that we see in the World Tour. Right. Which is something that I think, Amber, you were the one that brought that up to my attention. You're like, yeah, it's like all in the same area. This is a while back.
Yeah.
It blew my mind. So it's all kind of like within this compact area. Are the races that you're doing kermesses, are they, because criteriums, for example, usually don't have climbs. Road races typically have some sort of variation within them. Circuit races also tend to have something like that. So do these kermesses like avoid the bergs that we see on TV? Do they involve those? Do they try to stay flat? What's it like?
I would say like your typical kermesse would be probably, you know, so it's, you're going to your registration tent, which is actually a bar. So you're showing up on a main street of a town. And so you go to the, you know, you start on this main street and then you veer off a main street and you take a left through maybe through a little residential section. And then you find yourself probably 2 or 3 kilometers in a field on a farm road that's twisty and turny. And then you make your way back, you know, a loop back around to the main street where the finish is, where the bar is. So, I mean, it varies because whichever part of the region you're in, there might be a little hill, there might be a cobblestone sector, there might be, the depending on the wind that day, this 3K of this utter gutter crosswind, and you're just, if you make the front group on the first lap, great, but the race is going on the first lap, so you better be in the top 10. And it really just depends on where you're at, but there always is some type of variation or something to make animate the race.
And are they short like a crit or are they long like a road race?
They're in between 120 and 150 kilometers. So, I mean, you're looking at a 3 to 4 hour race. So it's basically attacking for 3 to 4 hours. It's insane. It's insane.
Pete, that's like, you don't want to go do kermesses.
No, those are way too long.
yeah, for sure. Well, so I want to talk a little bit about the tactics and everything else. So Pete and Amber, here's what we can kind of jump in with all of our different questions about this, but like from a 10,000 foot view, was your racing experience that you had like, or how was the racing experience different over in Belgium compared to what you had experienced over in the United States? And just from a basic overall view, we'll get into more specifics later.
Yeah. I would say mentality, aggression, actual will and want and drive, and just having it in cycling in Europe and in Belgium, especially, is like in their blood. It's culture. It's what they grew up doing. In America, you kind of like found cycling when you're like, oh, cycling, my friends are doing it, I'll give it a shot. And then all of a sudden you become good. I definitely think just the passion that boils in these, you know, Europeans, especially in these Belgians, is, that's the biggest standalone things I can say that variate.
Yeah. Amber, you kind of joined cycling like late in your life, right? So yeah. Did you have a huge like racing culture shock, aside from the actual culture shock, but like a racing culture shock when you went from the US to Europe?
From US to Europe, yeah. I was going to say when I got into it, it was very like similar thing. Like, oh, my friends are doing this, this sounds fun. But Europe was a very different beast and it differs a lot country to country. So I was living and based in Austria where there was not as much of a culture around it, but a lot of the teams I was racing for were based in Italy. So when I would be down there training with the team, it was amazing. I mean, people would recognize who I was. They would recognize the kit. They would know our team president, or, you know, they would know the whole roster and all of the stats. And that was something really wild that would never happen in a million years in the States. Like, no one knows who you are and they don't care. And it's so cool because in Europe, like, again, it depends on the country, but for most of the countries, people really do follow this stuff and they get genuinely excited about it. And I think one of the things about the kermesses that I think is really cool that helps perpetuate this is kind of a chicken or the egg thing. They're so spectator friendly. They are built for spectators. And so when you live anywhere around there and there is a kermess, it is like the place to be. And that's where everyone wants to be. And everyone wants to be involved somehow. And it just, it feeds this wonderful culture where people love it and they're so passionate about it.
Mm. Yeah,
actually touch on that real fast?
Please, yeah.
Yeah, the word kermesse is actually a carnival. And so way back when, they would have actually a carnival with rides and, you know, fair foods and people. And then they would have this race at the end of the carnival and they'd race around the carnival. And so it is like what she was talking about. It's just this so engaging and just part of the culture. So that's how they're set up. This so people oriented friendly because they're raced around a fair.
That's awesome. That's like so different than the industrial park crits. Right? Yeah. Totally different.
Like in the States, we're trying to find like the most isolated, least frequented, you know, totally. Middle of nowhere. Like, where is nobody going to care that there's bikes? And sure. So just the polar opposite.
How funny. I've never thought of that before. So Pete, if you could kind of like describe... So actually, let me describe my perspective of amateur, like Cat 3 level racing. And then Pete, if you could kind of describe how racing kind of unfolds at your level, and we can go through there. So like at the Cat 5 level, everybody in the US, everybody wants to sprint to the finish line. They like, because they've seen that on TV and that's how the race is going to end. So then like, that's kind of what everybody does. And it only gets spoiled when somebody really fast shows up and they just kind of ride and they ride away from everybody. And that just is, that's the Cat 5 experience, right? Then you get into like Cat 4 and 3 and there's still no team organization, really, like effective. There's not a lot of team organization. So you usually deal with like attacks and counterattacks, but a lot of the rules that we hear about with cycling in terms of like what you should do when this happens in a race, whatever that context is, they kind of break in Cat 3 and 4 racing a lot of the time because it's just not very organized, right? So it's kind of hard to follow. But then, Pete, at your level, when you have a team and you're racing at these USA Crit Series races, how would you describe, like, what's the basic racing dynamic that exists?
Yeah, I would say it kind of boils down to your team and, like, your strengths and kind of your commitment to how you want to race the race or how you want to win the race and something like that. But even still, it's not very... it's not very refined, even at my level, right? Like, I still think that in the US, people generally think they're good at a lot of different parts of cycling, right? Or they have a wide skill set. And, but really, they're all kind of more leaning towards mediocre and they don't have any real strengths. And then kind of it's the people who capitalize on their strengths the right way are generally, and with their team, are generally who wins races in the arena that we're in. But it's still pretty noticeable that people still make mistakes all the time. People still they chase teammates. I mean, it still happens all the time where the rules that you were talking about exist, but they're followed more closely, but it still isn't, you still see people doing things that you wouldn't choose to do if it was you. And it happens all the time. So I don't know. I feel like it's an evolution and it's getting better at my level, but then I'm sure Eamon sees it a little different over there.
Yeah. What's it like for in the racing you're doing, Eamon? Because it's not like that world tour level that we're seeing on TV, not like that level that Amber was racing with teams that are, you know, like the peak of the peak. But it's so interesting because we never hear about this form of racing, really amateur racing, particularly in this context. So is it like the USA Crits kind of level in terms of teams are mostly organized, or is it, like you said, just knife fights, individual stuff?
Yeah. There is some organization. There is some order. It's not as, you know, everyone's going with guns and just blazing everyone down. No. Teams do work together. teams do have objectives, and you do need teammates to win, I would say, 50% of these races, because not all of them are going to be won solo. Not all of them are going to be won in a small break. And you do come to the line, then you do need a team to get you to the line, because it's just so chaotic. But I would definitely say you start the race, then you got to make the first, 50 man selection. And then hopefully you have three guys in there, and then you guys can play with each other. And, you can get two guys up the road, or you and another teammate can get up the road, and you find yourself with, eight guys out of that, 25 man selection. And then that's the race. And then you guys work together, making sure you trade off attacks or cover attacks. And then you get in that last lap, and whoever's the strongest and fittest guy, I'm going to say, hey, how are you feeling? Not good. Do you want to leave me out? Sure. That's usually how our team works. And I mean, we definitely have four or five finishers on our team, but no one ever goes into the race thinking I'm the guy today. It's basically get yourself in the opportunity to win and then discuss who's going to win.
Well, that was like the biggest learning right there for amateur teams. Because like how many amateur teams do you see before him being like, he's our guy today. And then
for
you
sure.
know what I mean? Like that's like a yeah. really,
your guy approach. Has to make like the six or seven steps to the end. Like, you got to get to the finish before you say I'm the guy.
That's a really good point. I like that, of basically like kind of having like co-leaders, so to speak. You mentioned actually, you said they were a finisher. What would you define as a finisher? What sort of athlete is that?
Yeah, someone that can win. Someone that, has the traits and the characteristics on and off the bike of being able to lead and prove that he's done it in the past and can finish it off. Like, I'm going to look at you and be like, I can do it, but I need you to die for me. And I've told guys, I'm not good today. I said, you don't have a choice not to be good today. I can win. We can win. And I need you to ride until you dropped out of the break. Yeah. And they did. And I won. And I was like, I told you I could win, and you did exactly what I needed you to do. And you're awesome. Like, I'm so grateful for you. Like, let's go get some beers. Like, that's what a finisher is.
So that's the end part is just like amateur racing, but everything else in the middle is entirely different from what you just said. So, <Yeah. laughs> but that's
true,
because that's so once you commit to something and follow through with it, that's how you build confidence. Right. And then that ends up building, and that is what ends up building the team's confidence. So did you have to change the way that you raced? Like, are you a different racer now than you were?
No, I've always been pretty, go-getter type of racer. I've never really been like I'm going to go find the race. I'm not going to let the race come to me. And if I'm good that day, like, then I'm really going to find the race. But if I'm not good that day, then everyone's going to watch me and they know I'm not going to have that extra 5% to just do what I need to do. But I think also coming, because I did race at the pro level in 2018 for a continental team, and did a handful of world tour level races with Quickstep at Lotto and all these big level teams, was forgetting that there's, in these, those world tour settings, the break goes in the first hour, then you eat and you take a pee and you go to the team car for 2 hours, and then you ride hard for an hour and a half, and that's the race. Like, that's the plot. Like, that's the whole story. That's how it's going to happen. Every time you can roll a dice, and that's how it's going to be. But then I kind of transitioned back into these Kermesses when I signed with Shifting Gears in 2019. And I was like, oh yeah, like, that's not how it's going to be. Like, reset, bring your killer instinct back to the beginning, because basically you have to be a killer in the beginning to get to the finish in the right group. You can't wait, because if you wait, then 10, 15, 20 guys are up the road and they have a minute and a half and you're never going to see the finish line in the front group. Hmm. So it was definitely a transition.
That's like a different, so there's the opposite of that. A lot of the time is referred to as like negative racing, in the sense that like everybody just kind of waits and then they don't want you to get too far up the road, sort of a thing. Amber, was that like your experience in world tour racing? And what I want to get to is like, how do we manage that? Because personally speaking, that's something that I've encountered quite a lot, is that sort of racing where it's like, look, like, we're not going to make the break happen, but we are, so, you can go up the road if you want, but we're not going to let you get far away. So is that something that you encounter mm-hmm. regularly? And how do you, as an amateur, how can we race against that effectively?
That's a good question. And I think there's a couple, I want to step back for just a second, if it's okay, and talk mm-hmm. about what we were saying. I want to just make a comment in defense of the amateur teams who are racing differently, because I do think that there's a key difference here. And Iman, please jump in if I'm not getting this right. But one of the things that I noticed was, especially in Europe and especially in Belgium and in the Netherlands, where the roads are really narrow and they're really technical in the sense that you have a lot of turns and there isn't, you know, you're not on like a four, some of these, even the office park crits, they're like four lanes wide roads.
Freeway.
So much space. But when you're racing on roads that are really narrow and there's just no space, you're really depending mostly on positioning skill. So you don't actually need a lot of teamwork as long as you can put yourself in the right position. Like you don't need, it really helps to have a teammate put you in position if you need to. But if you're really good at positioning, you can stay in the draft and you can be sneaky and be exactly where you need to be. And that's a lot easier to protect a position like that if you're good at it when the roads are really narrow. But in the States, when you have these huge wide open roads, everybody's vulnerable to attack all of the time. And so you actually, what ends up happening in order to get to the finish, in order to make the selections, is you need teammates who are going to be covering attacks and shutting down breaks for you if you're the protected rider. So it actually makes sense in amateur racing in the States to sometimes say, like, this is our guy, because we need to save someone and make sure that one person is going to be fresh and not chasing everything down and not shutting everything down. Whereas in Belgium, in these Kermesses, you can have like four guys who are super savvy positioners just be in the right place and make those selections based on positioning. So I don't want to like hammer too hard on the American amateur teams, because like there is a reason to race that way. That's not just, you know, being silly and chasing down the wrong stuff. So I don't know, Iman, does that resonate with you?
100%. I couldn't really say it any better myself. You're right. I mean, in America, you have these, you know, huge boulevards in these industrial parks built for semis moving through. And, yeah, you know, it's really the truth. But when you come to Belgium, it's those farm roads, those crosswind sections, those little intricate parts of the course that are so crucial. Like I said, like if you don't make the first 10 guys, the race is gone. Like, see you later. See you never. And you actually just have to be really strong to just get to that point. And then like the wind or the stones, or, you know, if you make that first echelon, we'll do it for you. So yeah, it's just being smart. It's being able to know where you need to be at the right moment. So, I mean, it's not always being the strongest. It's being the smartest and knowing how to be sneaky. So yeah.
Yeah.
Amber said it great. Fantastic.
That's kind of an interesting point. Then maybe that experience racing in the US also still helps you in that regard too, just to, you have more tools in the tool chest, so to speak, right? In the sense that you're used to racing in that context.
It would be like having a center line rule the whole race in a road race.
that people actually abided by.
Exactly.
Like you actually had to respect it.
Yeah, good point. Circling back to the negative racing thing, Amber, like how, if I'm a racer and I'm in a situation, and we actually hear this pretty often, in particular from women who have submitted these questions, because a lot of the time they race in smaller fields, mm-hmm, and those smaller fields tend to have like a huge, like it's like a couple of really strong athletes. And then since it's smaller, you kind of get like those edge cases, but then the bell curve kind of sits outside of that. So how do you respond to that sort of racing, when that negative racing, when they just won't let you get away? They all seem to have enough fitness to drag you down, but they don't have enough fitness to actually make something work, or they just don't want to. How do you respond to that?
Quick definition here. So for folks that aren't familiar with the term negative racing, it doesn't mean like negative in the term that it's like bad or wrong. It's just a different, it's a random term, but basically what it says is if you have a couple people in the race who are clearly a lot stronger than everyone else in the field, and everyone else in the field knows it, then everyone else in the field is going to feel, you know, they're going to be much more reluctant to do a lot of work, because they know that they're going to be vulnerable to these other really strong riders. So they're going to look to the really strong riders to do most of the work, because they don't want to make themselves vulnerable. And they're hoping that their best chance is going to be to see one of these stronger riders do a lot of work, tire themselves out, and then actually get to that point. So everyone in the race is looking to these one or two riders to make the race, to create the race. And So what ends up happening is if either of those people is trying to attack, everybody's on them just immediately. Like they can't go anywhere because, you know, everyone wants to be in the break that they're going to initiate. You know, they don't want to let them get up the road because no one wants to have to chase them. But then for that person, it's really hard because like you want to get in there and race and you want to have a challenging race and you're willing to try to make that happen. But at the same time, it can get really frustrating because nobody's willing to work with you. Everything's getting shut down. And it makes for a really different race dynamic than if you had maybe two or three really strong teams and it was more of an even playing field. And it's just tough. It's one of those situations where you have to just accept the dynamic that's happening. And sometimes you really have to risk a lot to try to win the race. So if you're the person who's being marked, you have to be willing to lose and put it out there and really go deep and try to make the race hard, even though you know it's making you vulnerable to attack. And if you're the person who's not as strong, you have to be willing to be patient. And maybe, you know, you have to be willing to lose in order to win, basically. Like you really have to be willing to make that kind of a risk. Pete, I think you were going to jump in.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think this is a great example of in American racing, there's usually less opportunities to win, if you think about it that way, right? And so people in our racing, some people really want to create more opportunities to win, no matter what that looks like, whether that's, you know, riding really hard right at the gun. You know, like there's multiple ways to create opportunities in a race that suit you so that you have a better chance of winning. Where in Eamon's case, I think, you have to be at a high enough level, check all the boxes for the, you know, positioning, handling, getting there. And then the opportunities kind of, bloom, I guess, in the race, based on you checked all the boxes, you're there, you're fit, you're strong. And then the opportunities start coming to you. Where in our racing, it's up to everybody else since we don't, you know, depending on the course and what's going on, the opportunities are really limited. And so it's up to the racers to create the opportunities, or if there's kind of negative racing, then that shuts down more opportunities. And so to me, it seems like if that's something that you need to create more opportunities in a race for you to win, even if it is leaving you vulnerable, because without the opportunities, there's just no way it's going to happen.
And when you're talking opportunities, Pete, you're talking like an early break, winning from a reduced group. Also, of course, a sprint finish is it's an opportunity, but then also long solo break. It's like all of those different things. If you have that one card to play, then it's really tough. And if you're that one athlete who is being marked, like you said, Amber, then it's really hard because you feel like you're playing poker with your cards up, right? In the sense that like everybody kind of knows you and they they're kind of seeing what you, they know what you can do. So it's gotta be tough. So Eamon, is the racing negative over there that you're experiencing, or is it different? And if so, how have you had to change your approach? Cause when you race here, I can attest to this. It's quite negative and you are the marked man.
I am the man. I am. Amber was marked. Talking and I was just nodding my head. Yeah.
Yes.
Amber can answer all my questions. She can just talk for me.
She is pro. So, she is pro.
Yeah, no, she knows the whole, she knows the game, which, and Pete, I'm sure has been in situations too, but yeah, it's, you know, having the fitness, it's just checking all those boxes. But then, you know, being over here, like the other, you know, part of it is being in the game and knowing the game and getting in with the clicks. And like I said, you know, if you're in a town that breeds, you know, five of the hitters, you got to know who's from that town and who's good and who's willing to pay and who's willing not to pay. And you don't know the language and let alone the dialect, and you might be fit, but trust me, there's 100 other dudes that are going to ride you off the wheel just because they can. And so you might get lucky. You might find yourself, oh, I made the move. And you know, six laps to go, this is crunch time. There's only 15 guys left. Great. Trust me, 14 guys there don't want you to win and you will not win. End of story. If 14 Belgians don't, okay, let's say you even get more lucky and you make that last split in the last three laps and now you're in the group of six. Trust me, five guys there are going to crash you because they will not have you win if they think you're the strongest. They'll take you off the back. They'll yell at you. They'll do whatever they can. because you're, at the end of the day, you're taking what is theirs and they're threatened. And so, I mean, I remember before I got my call into the Belgian mafia, Kermesse level, so to speak, I was taking off so many breakaways and I was yelled at and I was, and it's discouraging. It's scary. You know, like, this guy is going to hurt me. But then it's, you know, like, you have to remind yourself why you're here, what you're trying to achieve. And you need to then almost play to his weakness and then almost stoop to a degree after the race. Hey man, like, I'm just trying to race. Or hey man, you want to go on a training ride? Or hey man, like, you want to get a coffee? You almost want to get in with the boys to then be racing with the boys and not be the outsider anymore and try to integrate. And that's why I've been here for also 10 years, you know, trying to integrate to then be able to be a key player. Like, it's really, it's about the integration and about being accepted and being almost giving your pass, like, all right, you can race now. Like, you've showed us you're not coming to take somebody, what's ours.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, somebody once said to me, you're not here to make friends, but you don't want to make enemies. And I think that's a good way of putting it. Like, you're definitely super competitive on the bike and you're not going to give an inch when you're on the bike. But like you said, you don't want to, you don't actually be wanting to make enemies with everybody in the field, because there is an etiquette.
There's a price to pay. You know, like, you don't want to be that mean, loud American.
Oh man.
Everyone's going to know you, you know, like, and my personality, I'm hot headed on and off the bike. And so I really had to learn how to dial it down, how to simmer down, how to shut my mouth and play the game.
Hmm. And this is interesting because we're talking like a very high level of competition, right? Locally, this probably exists for some people listening to this, maybe even at just like the very, at the group ride level even, you know? But it is under, it's whatever the dynamic is, it's important to understand it for sure. Iman, you mentioned something that you kind of have to, almost like the ticket punching, where you kind of have to be this tall, that you have to, you know, not this tall, but you have to be this fit. Right. You have to have this sort of race experience. You have to have that sort of stuff that gets you in the door. So how do you race successfully like that? Because a lot of the time us amateur athletes, we don't really know whether to focus on a sprint, or we don't know whether to focus on breakaways. We don't know how to kind of find our way to success, like which opportunity, like Pete was talking about, is the best opportunity for us to win. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So how do you do that in this sort of racing? Like, how have you somehow limited, or I guess found the ways, like, how are you going to succeed over there? Because in one respect, you could just say, well, you just have to be really fast and that's it. But I'm sure that you've found that there are certain situations or certain opportunities that better suit you. So how have you prepared for those?
I've learned to be dynamic. And I mean, I don't think many people can say this, and I don't say it in an arrogant light, but I'm just gifted with this huge aerobic capacity. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, unless we're going flat out for 90 minutes, then I'm not going to be a key player. But I mean, from 30 seconds to 30 minutes, like, you're not going to drop me. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have a lot of different diverse ways to make opportunity. I mean, I can attack, I can go solo, I can have people, I can go solo and have a brute come to me. I can position because I have that ability. I can ride my bike well. So I would say to have the most success, you want to be the most diverse rider you can be. Like, if I just went to every race and said, I'm sprinting, I'd be sprinting for 30th. If I said, I'm just going to attack, well, I'd probably just attack until I was dropped and I couldn't even, you know, pedal my bike. So, I mean, you have to just be this fit, diverse, knowledgeable, influential character in this Kermesse level of racing. It's really just, you have to be the perfect bike racer. It makes you the perfect bike racer. Mm. It really does. Like, I have teammates and competitors that are better than me sometimes too, you know, like, I'm not always winning every race. And it's, you look at how they, you know, you reflect after the, you know, you drive home or at dinner or on a training ride, you're like, how did I miss that? What did he do? Mm-hmm. How, you know, what was happening? Why did he get up the road? Why didn't I get up the road? Oh, it was this. Oh, it was that. And you got to pick and you got to, you know, pull and you got to, you know, take where take what you can get to build your own, you know, monster, and you become even more unbeatable.
So I think one of the things that you just said there was really important, that you recognize in the opportunity what you should do. Like you just said, whether that's going to be, you're going to go solo and let people catch you, is a much different effort than if you're going to chase down the group of four, right?
For sure.
And so if you're recognizing what is a better choice out of multiple choices at each of these points in the race, it's like the recognition that's making you a good racer. Like you have the really expansive tool set, which helps for sure. But recognizing which choice to make over and over to still create the opportunity or to capitalize on the success that each one is. So you're saying that, like, really one of your best skills is that you can recognize right now what you think is going to happen, place your bet, do what you're supposed to do, and then that's going to get you in a better situation moving for the next one. And then there's another opportunity that you have to recognize and then capitalize on and then do it again and again
and again.
Of course.
And it just becomes more refined and more refined and refined until you're at the line with four guys.
So it's less about knowing beforehand, like, this is going to be the one card I'm going to play, but instead it's about making a series of right decisions. I think even Amber and Pete, you probably said that during one of the race analysis videos, I believe I remember, but it's building upon right decisions. Is that correct? Good way to summarize.
Of course. 100%. I don't think it could be said any better.
Got to make the selections, and then you got to make the next one, and then you got to make the next one,
which is really different, right? Sure. Because a lot of us just think like, okay, the sprint, like I just need to work on the sprint. I'm going to, it's this climb that's going to be decisive, something like that, you know? So it is a different way to look at it. Hopefully we can learn from that. A couple things that I really want to get into. Number one, Pete, you mentioned that, and I'm sorry, this is a bit of a tangent perhaps, but you mentioned that an effort that is a person that's trying to bridge up to a group of four, or a person that's trying to initiate an effort then have a group of four catch them, would be different. How would that physically be different? Am I going to go all out in one, not all out in another, or what's the difference?
I think it's really, I know the reason for me is because it's much easier to get caught by four guys than it is to chase down four guys. and I mean that in both in my physiology and the way I like to race. So for me, it's much easier to snap super hard, take advantage of a situation at the front of the race that gets you a little gap, and then put in real work to get far enough away that you're still tantalizingly close, but not close enough that it's not just going to elastic back together. And so that's one where you kind of throttle down to stay, I mean, very small, right? We're talking like minute percentages, but you're going to throttle down so that you're ready when the catch happens. You're going to be able to work in. You want to tease out who's going to play with you. And this happens in all levels of racing, even like the morning or, you know, a Saturday morning ride. This is the same application where you're just getting far enough away that it's not an easy bridge, but you're ready for whatever is going to happen next. And you're going to try to set yourself up for success for when that catch happens. Because it's not about you going all out for the next 40 minutes or 60K or 100K. It's about how to be ready for the next step of the race that's about to happen.
Yeah, so it's not all about just completely, you know, emptying the tank and going as hard as you possibly can, right? Another mistake that I've made plenty of times. On the note of mistakes, Iman, what tactical mistakes have you learned from over there that you are making that now you've learned from and you've changed your approach?
I was actually just talking to Serge Powles on our training ride about this today. It's crazy because you think, you know, when you're in the heat of the moment and you're feeling really good, but you still probably have 40 to an hour worth of racing left. Like those last couple matches in the last lap, those real big attacks, those real big surges, those are when you need to have the sugars. That's when you need to be like the man. Mm. And I would think I did a lot of learning, you know, I would ride too hard, or I would try to like not flex, but show like I'm the guy here. And I would like pull through maybe for an extra 20 seconds, like handfuls of times. And that 20 seconds is now 5 minutes at over threshold, or over, I don't know, 130, 140, 150% of threshold. And you're just cooking yourself, and you just don't have those two or three matches in the last lap when you're watching those guys just ride away and they're not going harder. they just have that extra percent that you burned 4 or 5 laps ago. And it's just like, I just want to rip my hair out because I was like, I was the best guy here. Like everyone knew it. That's, you know, but I had an ego and I let myself, you know, get ahead of myself. And I stopped riding like a machine and started riding like a human. And let the human aspect take my brain over and ruin a lot of, you know, opportunities. So when you start to, you know, watch yourself, I know, slipping out of your hands, you need to be like, come back here. Stop that. You're the best guy here and everyone knows it. So just let them try to drop you and you don't need to drop them. You've already made the last, you know, critical move. You just need to make it to the line now.
Yeah. Amber, did you come across any, like when you went over to Europe, tactical mistakes that just stand out to you that you were like, man, I really need to stop making these sort of efforts? And Pete will end up getting the same question for you, but tactical mistakes.
For me, it was 100% about positioning. Cause like we were talking about earlier, it's such a different beast when you're positioning in a European peloton versus in the US. And then it was very frustrating because I'd get the hang of it in the Italian peloton in Italy. And then we'd go up and race in Belgium and it would be a completely different story again. So that was, for me, that was the really, the big, big lesson was getting a handle on being able to position in within different dynamics, right? Because there's a different, there's the dynamic among the riders, and then there's how the dynamic among the riders plays out on a specific terrain. And those are two kind of interactive factors that come together to create like the whole, I don't know, environment of the race. And so figuring those out was like such a steep learning curve. It was really frustrating. And what was most frustrating was like the better you get, the more aware of your mistakes you become. And you get to this point where you actually can feel it as it's happening and you're like, no. And it's so frustrating because you start to feel like you're getting worse as an athlete, but actually that awareness, it means you're getting better that when you become more aware of these mistakes. And eventually you get so good that you become aware of them and you can fix them as they're happening or then even before they're happening. But it's a very frustrating process.
When you say getting good at positioning, what do you specifically do better when you're good at positioning? Like, cause that's one thing a lot of people are like, okay, just be in the right position. So then they're going to try to do that. And they're just going to blow themselves up. Right. Cause they're like pedaling so hard to try to stay third wheel or something.
Right. Just be in the right position. It's really, it depends on the situation. It's very contextual. So ideally you want to be in a position where you can access the front. So you are in a position to respond if something happens in the race. You're in a position to see what's happening in the race so that you can see if you need to respond and be in a position where you can see what's happening. You can respond if you need to, but you're not in the wind. And then even better if that spot is not a spot that's being constantly contested, because that's another mental drain, is like constantly defending your position. And sometimes you can find like a sweet little spot where you can kind of sit for a while, but it's very rare. But eventually that cognitive load of fighting for and protecting a spot will come down. And it's less about protecting a certain place and more about just constant, it's almost like you're living in negative space. Instead of being aware of the riders and the road, you're aware of the space between them. And like, you're just living in that space. So the second, like just a little tiny crack of negative space opens up, you're in it. And you start to realize, I think Iman, you mentioned this earlier too, like you can fit in really tiny spaces that you did not know that you could.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big dude.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're like, whoa, I can actually be there and it's fine and it's safe. And then that opens up this whole world of doing that. But it takes a lot of skills. So this isn't something that you just go out and say like, oh, I should be able to squeeze into a smaller space than I think I can. Like, don't start there. Don't start there. But you do want to start to like think about, you know, where would be a good place for you to be where you could access and respond if you need to, but you can still be out of the wind. It's not always third wheel. And it depends on where you are in the race too. If it's really early on and you don't have a selection point coming up anytime soon, like maybe you want to drift a little further back, grab a bite to eat. You don't want to be up in the front where people are kind of like surging and slowing. It's contextual and it takes a lot of experience, and it depends on the field too. Like, who's there? How big is the field? How long is the race? These are just things that you learn with time and experience.
So Amber, what you just mentioned there is interesting, because a lot of people chalk up the good positioning thing up to like talent, or they just kind of put it in this black box of experience. Oh, they're experienced, so they're good at it. But you just really kind of broke it down as far as being in the right position to really be aware of the race, but not be driving the race and not be paying the price to be up there. And that's like that's something that I've noticed that racing, I can't say I've ever really seen Iman race because he's at the front and I'm off the back. But with Pete, I've noticed this is Pete seen at times. I'm like, how did he know that was going to happen? Like, it's amazing. Like Pete seems to have this intuition, but it's because he does those things that you're talking about, Amber, so well. It's that always being able to read the race and put yourself in a position to read it. And of course, having that huge database of experience to be able to, you know, use and to roll with. But, Pete, what tactical mistakes do you make? Because you kind of like what Iman said, Iman likes to bring the race out rather than wait for the race to develop. And you are absolutely that sort of racer. Like, you do not like sitting at the back. You don't like waiting for the race to unfold. So what tactical mistakes have you made and learned from?
And I've kind of always been that way. And Eamon's definitely always been that way, which was pretty fun. I enjoy people that like to grab the race by the scruff of the neck. It's a good time. But I think it took me the biggest challenge I faced for a long time, and it was a couple of years for me to do this, was figure out that there's a possibility to use less power and stay in the race, like at a very basic level, like pedal less, brake a little less, just be more efficient, be more smooth. And what you want to do is, instead of leaning into the front of the race and always stretching things out and pedaling a little harder than everybody else and showing that you're strong, it took me, I mean, dozens, hundreds of races to figure this out, that you can do less work and still be in great position. You can always be kind of, you always have a lot in reserve if you're doing the bare minimum to stay with the front of the race or the breakaway or something like that. And then all of a sudden, for most people, you know, it's only a handful of percentage points that the front of the race is different by fitness wise. So if you can be kind of just that little bit smarter and a little bit more efficient and read the race a little better, and it's just these micro transactions that are slightly less and you coast a little sooner. But it took me so long to figure out that I used to talk about, like, oh, my normalized power was so high for that race. That was awesome. And my teammates are like, you're an idiot. Like, you didn't have to do that. You could have pedaled so much less and been in the exact same spot. And then you would have so much more at the end. And for a lot of people, it's just a percentage point or two. You're going to feel way different after an hour of racing if you're just a couple percent off. And so the way I think about it is, what's the bare minimum you can do to be where you want to be, instead of, I'm going to lean a little forward, I'm going to pedal a little more, I'm going to take slightly longer pulls and like push the front of the race. You want to just barely hang out at the kind of your bare position that you're happy with being, and do even slightly less, because since you have more in reserve, you always have the ability to kind of do the extra effort to get back into where you need to be. And for me, it was really noticeable that sometimes things happen and you have to make a huge effort and you go, oh yeah, that was a bad call. I definitely drifted too far back and that was a bad place to do it. But the majority of the time, you're saving more energy overall. So it does cost more occasionally, but overall, you're going to save more energy over the course of the race or the breakaway or whatever is happening. And reminding yourself in all those times where, what's the bare minimum I can do and still be here, changes the way you think about just about everything. And that was, like I said, it took me years, but it makes a big difference on how you feel at the end of the race, which is really what we're always after, or whenever that crux happens and something, it's up to you to make it happen.
Iman, great summarization there, Pete. That was awesome, by the way. Iman, you have had, so like you mentioned that you have that great aerobic capability. So you know, relatively speaking, you are outstanding at the efforts that are going to be longer than those 30 seconds, right? We're not talking about creatine phosphate stores and your absolute snap power sprint, which still you could probably tear all of our legs off, but still, just the same, relatively speaking, that's not where you're the strongest. Instead, it's the longer stuff. Have you changed your power profile kind of as an athlete since you started racing over in Belgium?
In regards to like more like catering to the Kermesse style.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like I'm going to change my tool set to make sure that I have the right proper tool at the right job. Correct.
Yeah, you got it.
That's the question. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've, you know, I just train hard, man.
Like, yeah.
That's, I don't know. I just train my face into my handlebars, to be honest with you, rather it's, you know, 40 20s, 45 15s, you know, 1 minute on, 1 minute off, threshold blocks, you know, over unders. I just make sure that I'm just empty at the end of every workout. You know, if it's just endurance, right, I'm not going to be empty. But if you know, Neil's prescribing, you know, ride hard, I'm going to ride hard. And so I'm going to make sure that I just have the best and the sharpest tools for the job every time. I don't really think I've, you know, changed my riding profile or my power profile. I probably trained smarter. I've bumped up my nutrition game. I've changed my diet. I've changed probably kind of smaller things off the bike, I think, that have allowed me to be a better bike rider on the bike.
What things have you changed off the bike that have made you, or the small things, like you said, that have made the biggest impact for you?
My recovery. My diet, I'm vegan now in the last year and a half, which has made astronomical gains in my recovery, in my energy levels, and my power numbers, and my ability to control weight, and the whole nine. I could go on. That's a whole other podcast, actually. but yeah, I really attest the last year and a half to being vegan, and I could only imagine how good I would have been in 2019 when I was winning, you know, all those races here if I was vegan. Mm.
This is, so that this brings up like a really common thing. I even see it on the trainer road forum sometimes where athletes, and granted, Iman, you're optimized to a level that most of us probably won't see. Right. So this is, there's a big grain of salt here, but I see a lot of athletes being like, no, I don't do crits because when I look at my power profile, I'm just not there. You know, like I don't have a really powerful sprint, or I don't do time trials because I just don't really have that long power. And I think it's interesting that you can race dynamically, like you said, based on whatever situations might come out, but you aren't like intentionally changing the athlete you are in terms of your performance capabilities to do that. Instead, it's much more about accruing that experience and making sure that you have the fitness to be able to act on those opportunities. So a lot of the time, I think us amateurs feel the pressure to like have an idyllic power profile that fits a specific type of outcome in a race. And that's when we can be successful. But
Like you hear a lot of amateurs and, you know, bike riders in general talking about like they're, you know, you ride next to a guy you never met and what's your name? My name's this, what's your name? Yada, yada. And then it gets to the question of what kind of bike rider are you? Like, oh, I'm a sprinter. Oh, I'm a climber. Oh, like I'm a time trialist. Like, no, you're a bike rider. Until you have a world tour contract that says this is what kind of bike rider you are a bike rider. Like, get out of your head, look at the whole picture, be able to take in the whole picture and act on the picture. Don't classify yourself. Don't box yourself. Don't prioritize, you know, compartmentalize yourself as one type. Then you're one dimension. You're useless. That sounds harsh, but you're useless if you're one dimension. You want to be three dimensional, four dimensional, five dimensional, so on and so forth, so that you are the total package.
Amber, you're nodding a lot to that one.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, preach. Yeah, this is something I think people get these stories in their heads about what they can and can't do. And it's like, if I'm a sprinter and that's the story in my head, then the second the race goes uphill, like I'm out. And instead of just being curious about, hey, let's see how long I can hang in. Let's see how deep I can dig. Let's just find out. It becomes this foregone conclusion before the road even turns up. And so I think a lot of people talk themselves out of things that they're perfectly capable of just because they get a story in their head about who they are, the type of rider they are. And I love that. Like you, yeah, just don't box yourself in, get curious, go see what you can do. I mean, who knows? You don't know yet. You don't know until you go.
Yeah,
it's true. I mean, I'm 185 pounds. I'm the heaviest guy always. And I've made it over some pretty solid mountains. So, I mean, that just goes to show you if there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah.
There's a will, there's a way.
Build the engine.
Pete does that repeatedly too. We have like a local road race that's like hilly and has like steep climbs. Yet Pete never disappears somehow. So try as I might. Smart
racing. It's all about using what you got, right? Like it doesn't matter what everybody else has. It's what you have and how you use it. Because that's really what it comes down to.
I mean, honestly, a climber's worst nightmare is all those folks that they can't shake on the climb who have really fast finishes.
Yes. Right?
Right.
Because if I already played my card and you match that, and then I'm out of my element and you're there, oh goodness. Like I'm in a serious amount of trouble, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Iman, so what's next for you in terms, like, is your goal to end up, you know, you're even dubbed an article, the Kermesse King, which, by the way, pretty sweet title. You're dubbed that. Is your goal to end up getting like a world tour contract and go in that direction with this? What's your ambition?
Yeah, the end all be all goal is to for sure be world tour rider. At the end of 2019, I was in a handful of talks with Pro Conti and world tour teams. I did some testing at the MAPE training facility for that data. And, you know, I was really just right on the edge. I had such a successful year. It was great, but it didn't happen. And then COVID happened, which really I needed 2020 to just be like another, like, I'm here. I wasn't a joke. I'm backed up my training. I backed up the winner. I backed up the results. I'm really a key player. So, just 2020 really did not do me any justice like the rest of the world. I'm not over here making a sob story, but, it was frustrating. But also when I was at MAPE, I had these coaches going over these files and looking into my power profile and my ability. And they saw I'm 28, but the gap was still so big for development. Like I had not reached my true potential. And so they're like, you're older, but man, you really have a lot of room still. So that's really promising. And that's what we really like to see. And that's what's going to give you that chance. Because as we go talk to these directors and these trainers and yada, 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 there's an opportunity still. And so I'm just doing what I can every day to be 1% better, to make sure that, you know, that I get that call up and, you know, I'm making the right steps to hopefully one day be a world tour rider.
Iman, you mentioned that you have room to grow. What's your threshold? And then you mentioned that you're around 185 pounds. I'm sure you know what it is in kilograms, faster than me going to Google for that.
Yeah. But. So I'm right now I'm 83.5 kilos.
Cool. And then what's your threshold?
My 20 minute or my hour?
Let's go with 20 minute. That's probably the most relevant to a lot of people. And then we can do hour.
450 right now.
450. So I just want to like put that into perspective for a lot of people, because I've felt this before. I've felt like, I'm like every year I'm just bumping against my stops. You know what I mean? Like I'm like, And the reality is, you know, and I may be there, I don't know, but the reality is that even an athlete that you, that's at 5.3 watts per kilogram for your 20 minute power there, you've got room to grow and you're excited to be able to reach that. That's cool to me. That's inspiring to me. So like, I appreciate hearing that, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I remember being psyched on, you know, I was heavier. I was probably 89 kilos when I was younger and more muscle mass, and I was racing crits and I was only doing like 420, 430. And I was like psyching. I was psyching on that. Well, I mean, in my line of work, like you're barely getting by.
Sure.
Yeah. You're at the bottom of the barrel watts per kilo wise. Like you better make some changes, bro. You're going to lose your job.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is motivating and it is encouraging and it's really exciting and fun. And it's my passion. It's my life. It's what I was born to do. And, you know, it's inspiring and it's cool to inspire others and talk about it. And yeah, it's awesome.
That's cool, man. Iman, where can people, there's been a ton of great takeaways on this. And I hope if you're listening to this right now, go down below in the comments and let us know one of the takeaways that you saw or a question for us or Iman. Throw it into the comments if you're watching on YouTube. And if not, you can just do so at trainerroad.com/podcast if you're listening to the podcast. Because I'm curious to hear what everybody's main takeaway is or how they're going to race better as a result of this. That's the most interesting thing, especially because racing might be coming back soon, hopefully. So, which is so exciting. But Iman, where can people follow you on social media and get in touch with you?
Yeah, it's dropping my phone number now.
address.
Yeah, just want my address. You can pull up for dinner. It's cool. No, I got my Instagram, and that's just Iman_Lucas. Got Twitter. That's the same handle. I'm on Facebook, Iman Lucas. I'm got a YouTube channel. I got my vlogs going. I'm super on the vlog life. Nice. Traveled around Europe in my racing and just, you know, taking you places where you usually wouldn't go. So yeah, I'm on the platform. So Iman Lucas is everything across the board.
Cool. That's awesome. Iman, I appreciate you coming on. Also you raised the hair game substantially for us. I cut mine recently and I feel very inadequate next to you three.
You're looking suave though. You're just looking like Mr. GQ. That's what I appreciate of that look. Like if you would have put like a Calvin Klein blazer on and like some high water pants and some penny loafers.
Yeah.
Cocktail hour all day long.
This is why I like, we're going to have Iman on every week. This is great. My ego is doing fantastic. So, but Iman, you're just you're a joy and you're an inspiration. Thanks for coming on. And everybody listening to this, you should go follow Iman, support him, and get in touch with him now. So then when you're watching him on TV, it'll be really fun because you can say, I've known who Iman is, which will be
fun. And the cool thing, people kind of get a trip on, I reply. I like talking to people. And so please reach out, like, you know, Christian said, and ask questions. I might not get back to you right away, but I will get back to you because I really do enjoy connecting with folks all over the world.
For sure. Absolutely. Well, cool. Thanks so much. And for the next episode, we will be talking to you probably with a normal crew, maybe an adjusted crew, but we'll see you all then. And once again, in between now and then, just go to trainerroad.com/podcast and submit all the questions you have and we'll answer them soon. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.